everyone. Welcome to this episode. If you've come this far, with my friend Chris and I have conversations with people that we think are really interesting and insightful and living lives that people should hear about. And in this episode, we had a conversation with Mr. Spock's kid, Adam Nimoy, about what? About his new book, Most Human. And I as always, I read the book. You made your way somewhat through it, right?
I got through a good chunk of it.
Right. You're lucky that you have me here as the book as the book reader. Just FYI.
You are a better reader than me.
Well, I just do the work. But yeah, but you know, you have a lot of other things going on. It was a great conversation. Adam kind of looks like his dad.
But, he does.
And did you know that Mr. Spock grew up in Boston?
Only because I read the book and I watched the documentary from a couple years ago.
You read some of the book.
I read some of the book, yeah.
Right.
I don't know if Adam knew that you were from Boston until you started speaking.
Well, yeah. I mean, if he didn't get it when I talked about his wife, Martha, then
Martha.
It didn't occur to him. But as I said in our conversation with him, I think the book is interesting about his relationship with his dad. Find out some things about Leonard Nimoy you might not know. But then just kind of how he goes through his life with awareness about his relationships with his kids, with his wives, with his friends. I found it a good story.
Yeah. Again, the book is called The Most Human: Reconciling with My Father, Leonard Nimoy. And it was available for sale earlier this month in June. And it was lovely. He's learned a lot in his life from 12-step and from 12-step related reconciliation with his dad, which again is what a lot of the book is about. And he's a really thoughtful dude and a great communicator. I will admit, Sean, I don't know if I know the answer to this question. Were you a Trekkie?
I mean, I like Star Trek. I mean, I'm a nerdish.
I'm nerd adjacent.
Nerd adjacent. Yeah, that's the way to describe it. I fall right at fall right into that, like a little adventure. But I mean, am I dressing up? Am I putting, Vulcan ears on it? No, I'm not doing it. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but no, that's not my scene.
Well, I mean, I bring that up only because I definitely was not a Trekkie, but I'm sure I've seen every episode of the show because there weren't actually, as we talk about in the interview, there weren't that many or the conversation. But it was still, even if you didn't even really like the show,
there was still 78
there was still a lot. Well, I mean, more than they would make in a typical season of a TV show these days. But still, just a really, it came at a really formative part in our lives. And so everybody knows who all these characters are and feels some way connected to them. Adam was fantastic. I really enjoyed spending time with him. Just super honest human being.
Yeah, no, I think people will really enjoy the conversation. So,
all right.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chris and Sean. Hello.
How's it going?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. It's going good.
And we wanted to start by wishing you a happy Father's Day.
Thank you. To you guys too, assuming you're fathers.
We are both.
Yeah. Oh,
wonderful. Yeah, good.
Were you celebrated appropriately?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've got a couple of kids who are not in town, but I have a couple of kids who were in town, and I celebrate with my ex-wife and her extended family, and there's a lot of grandkids in that family. So, and I have a pool, so it's just a big party house here.
It's so weird. I mean, it's a little bit weird. I mean, this is the first time we're meeting, but I know about your ex-wife and your kids, and I mean, after reading the book, so it's kind of, yeah. Sometimes having these conversations are really kind of weird. Because I know so much about you because you've written.
Well, thank you for taking time to read. I really appreciate it, Sean.
Enjoyed
you're
it.
One of two people who completed the book.
Well, I'm 80% of the way there. If you want to deal in, you can round up.
He's not giving you full credit. 80 is like a B or a B minus, depending on sometimes. How you're getting graded.
Adam, we're excited to talk to you, and we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us. We got to start, though. I know from For the Love of Spock that you spent a little bit of time in your life as a deadhead. And I got to ask you if there are any shows that you attended that are standout shows that I should go find the recordings to before we move on to the series stuff.
The second show I attended was in November of 73 at Poly Pavilion. Very good show. I mean, a big one is Tampa, Florida from that fall tour, 73 tour. I was there for that. I was at one of the shows at the Orpheum Theater in 76, which they used to replay on the King Biscuit Flower Hour in San Francisco repeatedly. That was a good show. God, there were just, I, it's hard to keep track. I'm trying to think of what else that I would listen to that I was there.
But you spent time touring, it sounds like.
Well, I just spent, I never saw them out of state. I was here in California with them. I was living in Berkeley. I saw shows in Santa Barbara. I saw shows in Stockton, California. I just was all over California with them, but I never left the state.
Yeah,
but they played constantly. They were here. I mean, it's their home base.
Yeah,
sure.
So I was just listening to one recently. There were a couple of shows in Berkeley that were memorable, but I don't even know what the dates were. You know, to go to see them at the Greek Theater in Berkeley during the day with this great weather and these crazy deadheads. And then there were some shows at Long Beach that I saw that were great. I mean, there's just so many. I don't even know the dates.
Have you been out to see Dead & Company at the Sphere in Las Vegas yet, or do you have plans to?
I'm hoping to go maybe on the 1st of August, Jerry's birthday. I have to be in Vegas for the Star Trek convention then, and I'm hoping that weekend to go check it out. Yeah.
Have you gone? Is that a thing that you do every year, the Star Trek convention?
No.
Okay. Is that because of the book?
It's because of the book. Yeah. I mean, I love the convention, but I was there for the Love of Spock. We were shooting the convention, filming it. And then we went back to promote the film. But I haven't really been back since. I mean, you know, I like to have a reason to be there instead of just hanging around. Although I love hanging with the fans. I mean, they're just, they're so wonderful to meet. And when they meet me, they're like, they feel like they're touching Leonard Nimoy DNA, and they just get very excited, which is fine with me. You know, I love it there.
So one of the things that I'm always curious about, and maybe we could start here, is obviously your dad is an icon, having that role of Spock. And how did he? I mean, I get a little bit of a sense from the book, but not really. How did that wear for him? I mean, he's always, no matter what role he played. I mean, at some point he was always associated with Spock, right? Was that difficult for him to be so tied to that one role and that one character?
I don't think so. I think there was a lot that's been written about his first autobiography, which is entitled I Am Not Spock.
Yeah.
And then there was this whole issue about whether or not he had he wanted to distance himself from Spock. Was he typecast because of Spock?
Yeah.
There were these issues that came up repeatedly. And in fact, a lot of the fans were very angry with the title of the book because they love Spock.
Yeah.
And they believe that the only reason why there was no Star Trek movie was Leonard Nimoy didn't want to play Spock anymore. But I don't think that was the case at all. My dad has said repeatedly that the Spock character opened up a lot of opportunity for him.
Yeah.
And that he's very grateful for the character and that his favorite role is his alter ego, Mr. Spock. I mean, he apologized. He went on the apology tour by writing an autobiography entitled I Am Spock. So, the fact is, I don't think so. I mean, Spock, from Spock, he went to Mission Impossible. from Mission Impossible. He made a Western in Spain, and then he had a huge career in theater.
Right.
He had In Search Of came along, and then the movies came along, and he was directing the movies and producing the movies. I think it opened up a lot of opportunity for him. I think he was really grateful for the character.
But the story I make up about your dad is that he and William Shatner must have been BFFs, best friends. And I know from the documentary that your dad was very kind to his co-stars, et cetera. But were those guys, how tight were those guys?
How tight were they? Well, they were so tight that Bill wrote a book entitled Leonard, My 50-Year Friendship with a Remarkable Man, William Shatner, New York Times bestseller. It's lovely.
So did Shatner become like an uncle to you in some ways? Or?
Not exactly. I mean, but I always loved Bill. He was always very nice to me. My dad and Bill had a close period of time where they were really together. I mean, when Bill, suffered some tragedy of his own, when he lost one of his wives, my dad was there for him and very, very much supported him. The fact of the matter is there was a lot of competition and a lot of friction between Bill and Leonard. Bill talks about it himself. And it's pretty well known among the cast that the two of them were, they were only they were born 4 days apart and they were like brothers, but there was a lot of competition. Yeah. And there were a lot of struggle between the two of them. And I think it's pretty well known. It's public record, as the attorney general would say. It's a matter of public record. Mm-hmm. The thing I think that should be emphasized is that they did come together for a while. And there were a number of years there where they were close friends. I say in the book, when my dad announced to my sister and I that his best friend was Bill Shatner, we were in shock.
Right.
Because he complained a lot about Bill Shatner. But the other thing is that, even with all that competition while they were making the original series, when the camera was on, they were brilliant together.
Yeah.
They were just brilliant. I mean, I think they're one of the greatest dynamic duos of pop culture of all time, and definitely in the top 10 easily. I just love, their relationship on camera, as does everybody else.
Yeah.
And then you throw in, DeForest Kelly into the mix, and you've got one of the greatest triumvirates since, the time of Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus, in my opinion. So, and I asked my dad, I was like, well, if you had so much competition and trouble with Bill Shatner early on, there was issues about pop, the popularity of Spock, right away when the series aired, and even though Bill was the star of the show. And my dad said we were professionals. We did the job and we knew what we were doing. So
It was funny to me to think that it was only 4 years, three seasons. It was only three. Yeah. Okay. I thought it was four, three. And, these days you don't do anything if it's not six or eight seasons and you beat it into the ground. Was there a reason why it only lasted three?
Yeah, they kept shuffling around the time slot, and then they finally, I think they ended up on Friday nights, and Friday nights is just a cemetery for TV because no one's home.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the magic number used to be for syndication, you needed to produce about 100 episodes.
Okay.
That used to be the magic number. Everything's changed now completely, but they only made, I think, 78 episodes of the original series. But it just caught on in syndication. And this is what this is what was going on when I was in college. I talk about this in Berkeley. I wasn't watching TV in the 70s, really. When I started going to college in 74, I started at UC Santa Barbara. I didn't even, I had a TV. I never used it.
Yep.
But then when I got to Berkeley, my TV died. Oh, by the way, it was one of the two RCA color TVs that my dad finally got. in December of 1966, we finally got color TV, and there were these two portables that because he did some ad for RCA, and I took one of them with me to college. And then when I got to Berkeley, it wasn't working, and I took it to a repair shop, and the guy said, "It's dead. Just give it up. It's over." So that was so we got it in 66, and I was in Berkeley in 77. That was 11 years later. But it was, it was in Berkeley when I discovered this whole thing about syndication. That's what brought the series back alive. It was just, they were playing it 5 days a week at 5 p.m. and all day, and on weekends. And then these Thanksgiving weekend marathons, they just played back-to-back Star Trek episodes. And people were watching, and it was a shock to me. You know, I would be studying at a dorm somewhere, and at 5 o'clock, the place would empty out because everybody crammed into the TV
room.
Come
on, really?
Yeah,
to watch Star Trek.
I'm curious about Star Trek, and I didn't recount this in total in this book, but
no,
there was one time I was with a friend of mine, and then I went to make a phone call to my girlfriend, and I came back and I couldn't find anybody, and I just packed up my stuff and I was leaving, and as I was going out the front door, I noticed the flicker of the TV in the room, and I opened the door and it was packed with students. and my friend was looking at me smiling, like, you know, because he knew I was Leonard's son, but no one else knew. And somebody actually said, like, either come in and shut the door or get the fuck out. You know, don't distract us. We're busy. Can I say that?
Yeah,
they didn't want to be disturbed during the Star Trek hour. So it was, I don't know. I thought it was just amazing. And this is what also kind of like fueled my dad's lecture tour, because he would go to these college campuses
and
all over the country.
Go ahead, John.
I don't know. I do. Yeah. So it doesn't really, I don't take across coming across in the book that it was difficult for you to be Spock's kid out in the world. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, it wasn't that difficult. No, I mean, the only difficulty came when I would have problems with him. You know, when I would have trouble with my dad and we were not doing well together, and then Spock would be everywhere. You know, he would show up on the cover of you know, some magazine in the LA Times, you know, every couple months, there'd be a cover of Spock, you know, or there'd be a billboard or there'd be an ad or, you know, I mean, he's just everywhere. So that was kind of a constant reminder. But other than that, no, and I never really, I never revealed my identity to people. I would always introduce myself without using my last name. You know, necessarily. So it wasn't really that much of a problem. There was one time in an English class I was in UC Santa Barbara, and the English teacher announced that I was related to Leonard Nimoy. She just knew because of the roster, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it was a little embarrassing. I mean, because, you know, it's a little embarrassing sometimes because I don't like that kind of attention. And that's why I say in my book repeatedly that I like the back row. I like to be anonymous, you know. I do enjoy that. And that was one of the things that really dissuaded me from ever thinking of going into the acting profession or becoming a celebrity like him, because there's no privacy that goes with that.
Right.
And I really enjoyed the privacy that I had of being able to walk down the street. My dad could never do that.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite pastimes is actually being with him on the street and being walking ahead of him or behind him and watching people recognize him.
Yeah.
That's a trip.
Yeah,
that was a trip.
I can imagine.
Yeah,
and was he okay? Did he like that?
Yeah. And, you know, and later in life, it happened less than I'd ask him about it. I'm like, does this still happen to you? And he's like, nah, it's like much less than it used to be, because, you know, a lot of people were just didn't know Star Trek when my dad was in his 80s, late 70s and early 80s.
Yeah.
It would still happen occasionally, you know. So
it's funny the story you recount in the Boston tour, on the Boston tour bus.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell the listeners that story? I thought that was pretty good.
Well, okay, it was a couple of things. First of all, when we got to Boston, and I didn't share this in the book. So we got to Boston in it was June of 2013, and this is after the Boston Marathon bombing. And we were going to, because we wanted to shoot a documentary of my dad talking about his life in Boston. It was sort of a bookend to the events of his life. It was like the last chapter on film of Leonard Nimoy talking about where it all began. And we couldn't get permits. I was calling up a production crew, and they're like, well, they're not issuing permits on the street now, because everything is so buttoned down because of what happened at the Marathon bombing. He said, if you want to just come in and we'll do a guerrilla style, we'll just start shooting your dad around town and just, you know, we'll run and gun is what we like to say.
Okay.
And we'll just do it without permits, without police, you know, presence or anything. So we got to the Boston Common and my dad was with us, and I got out of the car. We're going to shoot some establishing stuff of the Common and then shoot my dad talking about his life selling newspapers on the Boston Common. And the minute I got out of the car, a police officer came up to me and he said, you can't park here. and I said, okay, well, we're only going to be here for about 5 minutes. We're just trying to get some establishing shots of the Boston Common. And I've got Leonard Nimoy in the car. And he said, okay, I'll stand here and make sure no one bothers you. And he says, can I meet Mr. Nimoy?
He went that quick. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Just like that. Yeah. Just like that. Can I meet Mr. Nimoy? Yeah, sure. Yeah. Dad, come here. This is Officer O'Malley. Yeah. He's going to help us out for the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did your dad have any hint of a Boston accent, by the way?
No. The first thing he had to do when he came to Hollywood was lose his accent.
Yeah. Okay.
He was told that in no uncertain terms. The first thing he did, he went to a speech, you know, therapist, and he lost all that.
Yeah.
So after that, my dad, we took a break from filming, and my dad and I took a duck tour, which is, you know, they're all these ridiculous looking amphibious vehicles that drive around town and give you a tour of Boston. And when we were sat in the back, and my dad was, you know, incognito as usual, wearing a hat and glasses. No one would recognize him, even on the street. No one recognizes him when he's wearing his hat and glasses. And when we got off the bus and my dad introduced himself, first of all, the guy on the bus says, is there anybody, do we have anybody on board from the armed forces? And when were you discharged, sir? My dad was like, December 15th, 1955, just like that. I don't even remember, you know, I mean, I wasn't alive when he was discharged. My dad was in the Army Reserve in Atlanta. And he said, would be an honor, sir, if you would sign your name to the top of my butt. They had signatures of guys who were in the service. And then when we got off the bus, my dad took off his hat and glasses, introduced himself to the guy who almost fainted.
Well, because he on the tour, they were saying, well, here's where JFK grew up, and here's where this one grew up. And on the South End, Leonard Nimoy also grew up around here. And he's
not
in the
not a Southie. South End was a tough name.
Not the South
End. West End.
West End. And he's in the back of the bus. Which was pretty funny.
Well, I love that too. I mean, you know, I talk about that in the book. Is that, I mean, I love, you know, we were, you know, my dad was so nonplussed, you know, he just sit there, like, he's just like this nodding when the guy says, and, you know, they're talking about John, you know, Beacon Hill, which is right next to the West End, John Kerry and John Kennedy. And they're talking about John Hancock and, you know, and then we get to the West End and Leonard Nimoy. And I just, throwing that name, you know, that Russian name with those, the founding fathers is just, you know, and the, you know, it just, it was ridiculous. You know, and the West, the most famous resident of the West End, Leonard Nimoy, we have any Star Trek fans on board? Yay! You know, half a dozen people are like yelling, not knowing that we're sitting in the back. And my dad's just like nodding.
That's so good.
That was
so
Leonard. Good.
It occurs to me that my parents dropped me off at college, Sean, I don't know if you dropped your kids off at college, or Adam, if you did. I'm assuming that your parents did not drop you off at college, Adam. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, my mother, she came with me to UC Santa Barbara. She did come. My dad wouldn't come.
Because it would have been a shit show.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Yeah. I mean, look, according to my sister, I still think this is the most ridiculous thing. My sister felt that there was a lot of competition between me and my dad. He even wrote about it in the letter I talk about in my book, that he was in competition with me, which makes no freaking sense whatsoever. But I mean, the fact of the matter is he never came to UC Santa Barbara except to pick us up in his plane because he needed the flying hours. He came to Berkeley. He actually came to Berkeley twice. I had two incidents with him at Berkeley and they were both unpleasant.
Yeah.
And and my sister's saying, look, he's not comfortable with you being there because you're doing what his parents always wanted him to do, which was to go to college. Yeah. And whatever. I mean, I guess there's no other explanation for it. The second time he came to Berkeley, he came with my mother and he was so unpleasant. It was like, I almost said to him, dude, just go home, go home. Cause he was morose.
Didn't you, I mean, when you talked to his brother, was it Mel? Is that your uncle? Yeah. I mean, he kind of confirmed it too, right? About, you know, going to college and the whole thing.
Well, that's what they wanted because my grandparents were, look, they were Russian immigrants. They were Ukrainian, but they considered themselves Russian. Their American dream for them was to have their kids go to college and become professionals in the United States. That's the whole dream.
Yeah.
So when my dad said, no, I want to become an actor, they were just, you know, flummoxed, I think is a good word. They were not happy with him and they didn't support him and they didn't help him and they didn't come out. I didn't meet my grandparents till I was 6 years old. And that was only after we went back to Boston to see them. They just didn't have any contact with them, you know. And my dad, I found a telegram from my dad to his father on Father's Day, interestingly enough. Here we are the day after Father's Day. in which he was late in selling the sending the telegram, and he signed it, "Your love, your errant son, Leonard."
Because they
were very unhappy with him, and you know, and then Star Trek came along, and they were like, you know, giddy with excitement.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're right about that. How they kind of liked the attention. Right.
I mean, yeah, they love the attention. I mean, my dad, you know, in the documentary in Boston, we were talking about that. And my dad said they had no idea what Star Trek was. They couldn't wrap their head around it at all. All they knew was that something had happened. My dad said something big had happened, and people were writing, you know, fan letters. They were writing fan letters to my grandparents, and my grandmother would share these letters embarrassed. I mean, you know, it was ridiculous. It was so weird. It was so ridiculous. They would have these relationships with these fans who just adored them because they adored Leonard.
Hey, listeners. If you enjoy our show, please consider following us or sharing the show with a friend. And I want to take a quick second to shout out our sponsor, Half Acre Beer Company, from their iconic Daisy Cutter Pale Ale to the refreshing Bodum IPA. All of the beers that these guys are making are a testament to quality and to their passion for brewing. So cheers to Half Acre Beer Company for supporting If You've Come This Far and for brewing great beers. And now let's get back to the show. I was curious about the college. I'm curious about the arc of your relationship with your dad and where it was when you were in college. And frankly, even for those of us without famous parents, our resentment and disdain for our parents probably peaks around those years of our life, right? Teenage years into college or whatever, and you were starting to smoke weed and become a deadhead and everything else. Do you take any of that on? Like, was it a combination of him being at a, I don't know if he was at a low point, but you also being like, all right, you know, I'm kind of making my own way now?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, for me, the thing is that I just felt like I could have a little bit of an alternative lifestyle because I really loved the college years and I was doing well, you know, finally. I mean, my first year as a freshman, it was a disaster because I was doing too many drugs, frankly. And and I just couldn't get in the swing of what life was like in the University of California. And I was just flailing. I was just not in a good place. I was not in a good place with him. And I just didn't have a great living situation. And I just didn't do well in my freshman year. But when things finally started to get good, I just felt more confident and I'm more distant from him. You know, I was not at home. I didn't see him. He didn't come visit. We weren't communicating. I was chasing the Grateful Dead all over the state of California. I was smoking pot daily and trying everything, you know, doing hallucinogens at the same time. Uh-huh. And, you know, just really kind of pushing the envelope a little bit. And I just didn't have that much contact with him. And when I did, he was not that great to be around. So, it was a little bit of rebelliousness on my own. I was just trying to create my own identity and find my own way and, you know, felt more self-confident about myself. Look, I've been, you know, I played the role of Leonard Nimoy's son for so many years. It was nice to find my own, you know, way. Yeah. That's the whole point of it, really. And that's why I went to law school. I knew I was going to go to law school. And one of the motivating factors was it was something that my dad could never, ever do, and that distinguished me. And it was a real impetus. And it was like when my grandparents, his parents found out I was going to law school, they were just beside themselves because they just loved that. Yeah, they were just crazy about that. I mean, I had a really, really close relationship with them. I would be going to Boston during the summers of every college school year. I went to Boston to visit them because I love Boston. And I wanted to connect with them, you know, and they were like buying me school books and stuff. You know, I mean, they were so into it. So that kind of just kind of put more distance between myself and my dad. The weird thing was that he was also very proud of the work I was doing because I got a note from him when I was in law school saying that he was really proud to be able to tell people that I was in law school doing something. You know, I had a career, I had a path, I had an objective in my life. You know, a lot of Hollywood kids just like have a lot of struggle about where they're going and what they're doing and, you know, what their identity is. It's very complicated when you're a part of a celebrity family, but it's not because of the work you've done.
Yeah.
It's very confusing and it's hard to kind of like really break out of that and create your own identity. A lot of people do it, but a lot of people don't. So my dad, I think it was a mixed bag where on the one hand, I think he felt proud of the fact that he could help me get through school and pay the tuition. On the other hand, it was just weird competition with him.
That didn't translate to your kids, did it, at all? I don't get that sense from the book, but I mean, they're removed a little bit more from it as his grandkids, but was there any impact on them?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly not with me. You know, I mean, I had a just different relationship with my kids. I was not in competition with them, but I try to point out that even though I treated my kids very differently and not so consciously, as I point out as well, that I wanted to do it differently than my dad. I just did it differently because I love my kids and wanted to have more balance in my life. So I was really connected to them, and I knew, you know, I was with them. I took them to school.
Yeah.
You know, I took them to after school activities. I jammed with Jonah playing music and, you know, and Maddie, I helped her write her papers, you know, but they still found reasons to be really pissed off at me. I still made my own mistakes.
Right.
But I mean, I was much more, you know, and I had a lot of trouble with Jonah because he was such a failure in school. Mm-hmm. That's where I could relate to my dad. And I say in the book, there were a couple of times I came down on Jonah because he was just such a screw up and he wouldn't do anything, that sometimes I let loose and I could just hear my dad in my voice. I just knew it was my dad. Oh. You know, that was the way my dad.
I know that.
I mean, we try to break the cycle, you know, and still you make the same mistake, you know, you make your own mistakes, and they still find reasons to be just really very angry with you.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, the attitude or perspective you had with Jonah and what was going to work for him and what your dad's dad and mom had for him. I mean, he's like, I'm going to go be an actor. And he moved at 18 to LA. I mean, your son was very much, I mean, he was all about the music.
Yeah.
And trying to fit a kid into a model doesn't work.
Yeah. Really, a round peg into a square hole.
Yes. Right.
Well, the thing is, you know, that was the difference between, you know, with my dad's experience and mine. I mean, his mother and I knew that Jonah was a natural. I mean, he was a phenomenon as a musician.
Yeah.
We were told this repeatedly by his tutors, you know, both in percussion and drumming and in guitar. We knew it. But Jesus, could the guy do any homework? It was just ridiculous. He just refused to do any homework. It was just insane. And, you know, we didn't know what to do with him. You know, when he managed to graduate high school, I don't even know how that happened. But, you know, but then it was just, you know, we wrote about the fact that we wanted him to go to music school, which he didn't want to do, or get a full-time job, which he really didn't want to do. I mean, thankfully now, I mean, he's on the road. I had a half hour conversation with him. He called me on Father's Day from London yesterday because he's on the road with the Offspring.
So he's still with Offspring.
He's still with the Offspring, you know. And the thing about Jonah is he's identical to my dad. He's identical. There's a professionalism that he has that is so admirable. And it's just a carbon copy of the way my dad used to be. Like, you know, I mean, Jonah's a very bright kid for how undereducated he is. My dad was the exact same way. Yeah. And he just has a work ethic about his craft where, you know, he said to me yesterday, you know, being in a band with a couple of rock stars, it's this weird kind of dichotomy because on the one hand, there are rules. You have to show up. You have to do the work. They're pushing the envelope. They're trying to do it better. You have to be in the moment. You've got to, you know, they played 100,000 people outside of London 2 days
ago. That's crazy. Yeah.
You know, they got to be in the moment. They got to deliver the goods. You know, they want to be the best they can. And, you know, and Jonah stays in his own lane and he does his job and he doesn't complain and he loves the band. He loves those guys. On the, you know, there are rules, you know, of engagement. He said, on the other hand, I'm in a band with a couple of rock stars and there are no rules. Uh-huh. If, you know, if the pub closes at 1 and we roll in, the pub stays open till we leave.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He says this constantly. If we need to get food at a restaurant and they're closed, the restaurant opens up and they feed us. Mm-hmm. You know, this stuff happens all the time. You know, we get our way. We can do whatever we want to. So it's this weird dichotomy. And my dad was the same way. It's like, oh, Mr. Nimoy. Yes, Mr. Nimoy. Of course, Mr. Nimoy, whatever you need, Mr. Nimoy. On the other hand, my dad showed up, no attitude, did the job, engaged with the fans, gave the lecture, you know, did the work, showed up on time. You know what I'm saying? They're identical.
Yeah.
It's funny to hear, Adam, you talk about your son, you know, because you're like, on the one hand, it's like, you know, what in the world is he doing? And then you're like, obviously you respect him a ton and his talents and everything else. Can you say a little bit more about your relationship with him right now, especially as, you know, how old is he now?
Jonah just turned 32.
Okay. Like, are you guys tight? Do you write letters to him like your dad used to do to you? Like, how's it going?
I mean, we said text.
Yeah.
No, we're just on the phone a lot. You know, 2 years ago on Father's Day, they were playing in Germany, and I got a phone call. You know, it was in the morning here in L.A. I got a phone call, and he FaceTimed me, and he said, Dad, hold on a second. And he put his phone down, aimed at him, and he picked up his guitar, and they played the encore Self-Esteem with me watching.
No way.
Yeah. I mean, and I go out there. I was thinking of going out there this summer. I'm not sure I can do it because you're going to be in Europe again. Last summer I was in Madrid and Lisbon with those guys. I love hanging with them and things, you know, and there are bumps in the road with Jonah, but you know, there's enough connection and love that I have with them that we are able to get through this stuff. Yep. You know, on a pretty regular basis. I'm interested in him. The problem is I'm a crazy fan for The Offspring. That's the problem. I was a fan when they broke out back in 94 with their album Smash. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I listen to K-Rock, which is the alternative music station here in LA, and they're just in constant rotation. I mean, if you listen to K-Rock, you're just listening to The Offspring all day long. Yeah. And I just love those guys. And I have trouble reconciling the fact that Dexter and Noodles were their two original members of the band. You know, Dexter had these like these dreadlocks down to his, you know, down his back, and Noodles had these Coke bottle glasses and this long hair, and those are the guys that I just adored. I mean, they were my hero because they were like in your face, like F you, we're The Offspring, we're new, we're here, we're not going anywhere, we write hit records, you know, and let's have a good time. And then all of a sudden, you know, 7 years ago, Jonah gets a call. They're in Rome and they need a guitarist, because Noodles had to leave on a family emergency. And a friend of his knew them, and they called Jonah. He showed up in Rome. That was his first gig with them. And then they went to Prague. You know, he was just in Prague again. He said, yeah, we've been here, I think, 10 times since I've been in the band. That's the problem, which is why I'm always calling him, or he's calling me, and we talk for an hour about the band and the dynamics and what they're trying to do, and that those guys are so professional, and that they're at another level, and they don't want to be a legacy band, and they're trying to become bigger than they are, and they're playing all over the world, and they're booking everything, and they're like, and I talked to Noodles about it. He's like, yeah, we're in it, we're not done, you know, we want to keep the game going. Yeah. and they're, you know, it's just really I can't think of a better band for him to be in with his, you know, his taste in music than with those guys. And they love him. It's a big family. They're family guys. You know, they're good people. They're teaching him. He's learning the ropes, you know, and he's learning from the best.
My head here is going to something you said a minute ago, which is us as dads wanting to break the cycle, which I think is probably we're setting ourselves up for failure because it's just an unrealistically high goal. And I think the goal should be more one of continuous improvement. And it brings me to, you wrote about a big letter your dad wrote to you where he sort of outlined all of your failings and faults. And before I ask you to say more about that, you and Jonah have this relationship now where he can, this is like, if he listens to this podcast, this will not be the first time where he hears his dad say, oh my God, Jonah was a horrible student. And you know, what the hell was he doing? This and that. Is that their transparency there? Like, does he know how you feel about him and vice versa?
Yeah. I mean, everything that's in the book that I wrote about him, I read to him, you know, and got his approval. There was only one thing he said, you cannot put that in the book. The answer is no. I said, fine. I took out an episode with him, but yeah, I mean, he knows. I mean, you know, yeah, he admits to everything. He's proud of it. You know, we were together. I was talking about this at a bookstore when the book first came out, The Most Human, when I published on June 4th. On June 3rd, we had a bookstore event in Culver City, and Jonah was there, and I talked about this, about the fact that he was a complete and total screw up in school. And he's like, and he just sits there and smiles like he's proud of the fact, you know, because he was just, you know, he knew he had a singular purpose, and he knew what he was going to do with his life, and he is absolutely okay with it. The thing that gets weird is that my daughter, Maddie, who I was raising at the time, she's 2 years older than him, almost exactly 2 years. she did all the schoolwork. I mean, real problem what I talk about in the book is that she did all the schoolwork. She worked her ass off, and nobody, you know, comes up to her and tells her how brilliant she was playing at the noontime concert. I mean, the problem that she had was that he's a complete and total fuck up in school, but everybody keeps coming up to her telling her how brilliant her brother is.
Right.
Because they played these noontime gigs, you know, and everybody would gather around and see this performing monkey and how great he was, and she never got the credit. And I was like, I was really sympathetic to her about that because I felt the same way. I'm doing good work. I'm in school. I'm working my ass off, and all people want to talk about is Leonard Nimoy. You know, that's the real issue. I mean, he had no problem with me. I mean, I have a line in the book that says, you know, that Jonah insisted on taking Japanese, not studying Japanese, because the word study has no business being in the same sentence with my son's name.
Right.
So let's come back to that letter real quick, Sean, if we can.
Go ahead. Sure. No, go ahead. Because I'm going to change the subject after this.
Yeah, because I kind of wanted to get into 12-step a little bit too. You talk about this letter in the book, and you talk about how your friend was like, hey, count your blessings, in effect, like your dad just did step four for you. Can you speak about that experience a little bit?
It was kind of the low point in my relationship with my dad. I wasn't, you know, I'm in Al-Anon at the time and let go and with, you know, detach with love. That's kind of the mantra of Al-Anon when you have somebody in the family who's got a drug or alcohol problem. My dad was my qualifier because even though he was sober, but he wasn't really working a program at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, working the program is a program of action. It's a lot of work. You got to go to meetings and read the big book and work the steps and, you know, have a sponsor, have a sponsee, be of service, take commitments, have a higher power. I mean, I'm still in that game, you know, even now, 20 years later. My dad really wasn't that invested in the program, and he was angry. You know, he had a lot of resentment towards me, and the thing that was really hard for him was when I just said, okay, I have to step away from the relationship because it's too toxic. You know, I mean, our relationship was kind of defined by incredibly great times together, mostly celebrating all these incredible successes of my father. And also punctuated by these incredible episodes of conflict with him, you know, negative engagement, which was something he was okay with. And I just got, it's like, I just can't do it anymore because he's too formidable. I was never going to prove to him that he was wrong about anything. He's just too powerful. So I started detaching from him with love. I mean, I'd call him on his birthday and I'd call him on Father's Day. And he'd still be it would be very tense on the phone with him. And then finally, he couldn't take it anymore. And his solution to the problem was to write me a long letter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a 6-page letter. I think I got it in 06. I was 2 years into my recovery. And it was just a list of all the reasons why he thought I was a complete and total screw up and why he thought I was the problem in the relationship. All the stuff I had done that, you know, I messed up on. You know, a lot of the things where he tried to help me with my career and I botched it. And all the dumb things I did and said, and, you know, all the reasons why he resented me. It was just a list of resentments, really. And I did what I thought was the appropriate thing in recovery, which is to do nothing. I mean, it took me a while to come. I wrestled with it because I wanted to send him a 10-page letter of his shortcomings, of his character defects. Yeah. And he had plenty of them. I take the program to heart. I try to practice the principles in all my affairs, i.e. in my life, which is restrain a pen and tongue and contrary action and let God. And, you know, don't do something, sit there and count to 10, count to 20. I mean, these are all attempts to grow up and not react to stuff and, you know, not get emotional and strike back out, you know, and not have a resentment towards him. Resentment is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. It's just a waste of time. And resentment, Vigdig says, is the number one cause of relapse, was people hold on to resentments and they get pissed off about stuff and they get angry and they get all worked up and their mind starts going. And the next thing they know, they're going to have a drink to, you know, to take the heat off of themselves. So I did nothing for a while and I got a lot of support for that in the meetings I would share about my dad anonymously. You know, no one at the meetings knew that I was learning. Some people knew, but most people didn't know.
Yeah.
But my friend in recovery, Chris, in the book, you know, said, no, this is, you shouldn't do nothing. You should take some action here. This is perfect.
Yeah.
Because your dad has filled out the fourth, you know, column of your fourth step. you know, the fourth step being who pissed you off, how they did it, what part of your ego is involved. That's column three. And then the infamous column four, what was your part in it? Which is your own character defect. What did you do to contribute to the problem in your relationship with this person? And my friend was like, dude, he did your column four for you. This is great. This is perfect. He's done all the work for you. Go make an amends to him. And the reason why I didn't want to make an amends to him, because he was never made an amends to me, you know, and he was never going to make an amends to me, because Leonard Nimoy is never wrong. And it's not just Leonard Nimoy. I mean, it's a lot of people, a lot of guys from that generation who just, the word sorry is not in their vocabulary. Right. I mean, I know a lot of my friends that, you know, that are in my generation have these kind of problems with their dads. It's just, they're not the warm and fuzzy types.
Yeah.
You know, these depression era kids, they just weren't built that way. And so, I did make the amends to my dad. I took the action, even though I wasn't feeling it, you know, fake it till you make it, you know. You know, I mean, there's a lot of sayings in AA and they have meaning to me, you know, they do. And I did. Yeah. You know, I faked it and I'm good at faking it because I'm Leonard Nimoy's son. And I gave some great performances, you know, on behalf of Leonard Nimoy being his son. Mm-hmm. And that is showing up to things when I didn't want to. And, you know, there was one for his 75th birthday. I gave a very eloquent, you know, I wrote out a speech, I memorized it, and it was very eloquent and loving, you know, at his birthday party when I was freaking pissed off at him. Mm-hmm. And he was being really not kind to me at all. And I remember I went back to the film school I was teaching at, and I went up to the acting instructor, a friend of mine in there, and I said to him simply, I just want you to know, because I needed to tell somebody, I just gave one of the performances of my entire life last night at my dad's birthday party. Yeah, I mean, just to do the right thing. That's what recovery is about. Just do the freaking right thing and stop worrying about, you know, what he said or what he did. I mean, it's not, you know, we don't take things personally either in AA. And a lot of the stuff that my dad did was like, I talk about in the book, you know, he came at me when he was drinking, making the good mother. He was freaking miserable and he was letting me have it. You know, that's when he said his most famous line for me was, you're my son and you will stand up and you will take it. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. Sorry.
Yeah. You're alluding to lessons that you've taken from 12 step that may not be obvious to those of us who have not been through 12 step. I mean, I've participated in Al-Anon, which is related, of course, but like, I feel like you also wrote about how the making amends is not always for the other person. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, no, that is correct. I mean, there's controversy about that in the meeting. You know, I've heard contrary opinions. That's the great thing about being in 12-step recovery is there's no authorities. And you take what you can use and you leave the rest. And this is what I was told by my friend Chris in recovery, is that the amends is not for him. It was for me. It was a chance for me to let go of my own resentment. You know, just make the amends to him and give it up and admit to my own shortcomings. And don't wait for him to say he's sorry about what he did. It's not what it's about. It's about letting go of my own stuff and moving on with my life. And that was the case. You know, I had a lot. Look, it's in my hard drive. You know, I have a lot of reasons why I know what Leonard did. You know, I mean, I do know what happened with him. You know, we all do. You know, you keep an inventory of in your brain, in your hard drive, about all the stuff my dad did that where he was really not behaving appropriately as a father. I mean, I know them all. I can name them all. And there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Adam, I'm thinking about two things. One is I want to talk to you about Justin and Martha. And before we do that though, it's curious to me as I read the book, I get this sense that you talk a lot about dwellings. You talk about the places that you lived and where your kids lived and where Nancy lived and your parents and the renovation you did. And is dwellings and homes and spaces important to you? Am I over reading?
No. It's like, it's kind of subtext throughout the book and no one really picks up on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, having a safe space and building a place and having your you know, your own space and feeling good in that space and maintaining that space and what a house means to a family. It just represents so much. And it's so symbolic, you know, it really is about, you know, who you are as a family. And it's just, yeah, it's important to me because it's just symbolic of what happened, what occurred in those spaces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for example, I talk a lot about the fact that when I moved out of Clarkson Road, you know, I worked very hard to maintain that place and things started to fall out of control. So I talk about the fact that and again, it's subtext. I don't hammer it home. Right. I want people to pick up on this, that after I moved out, things started to fall apart on Clarkson Road.
Right.
But not only that, but Nancy and I were falling apart on Clarkson Road.
Right.
It's just symbolic, you know, that, you know, we had this knockdown drag out fight because I'm complaining about the fact that she doesn't maintain the freaking house. Right. You know, there's the two are related.
Right.
And the same thing with my mother. My mother was just in the long decline of her life on Cashmere Street, the house that Star Trek bought.
Yep.
You know, and when my dad was there and we were all living there, it was a vibrant, alive, beautiful, well-maintained home. But when my dad moved out, it turned into a freaking mausoleum. And and that's why I described the fact that the paint is fading or chipped and the wallpaper is peeling and there's junk everywhere and the floors are a mess. And that's that was a reflection of my mother.
Yeah.
Just a mess. It's just a tragic figure, you know?
Well, it sounds like you love a good rehab. I mean, you talk about your secret weapon and now I've got another one that I'm going to do. Is that?
Yeah. It's like,
still a
it
thing?
Is like, it is like rehab. It's like doing the repair work, work of our relationships, the repair work of our lives.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, the physical manifestation of that is the repair work of the houses that I was in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's just a lot of recovery to me. And again, I don't hammer it home because it's just, you know, it's poor penmanship to say, but without actually saying my house is a symbolism of my mother who's in the long time. You know, you just don't
I
say
hope that
would like
make
that.
It past your editor, actually.
It wouldn't make it past my editor. I mean, that's why, you know, that's why I work with Brenda so closely. It's like, I mean, I wrote every word of it, but she would say, no, you can't say shit like that. And I'm be like, oh yeah, you're right. Okay, good.
She should. Right.
Hey, Adam, real quick, I'm curious how you and Julie are you and Julie tight, your sister?
Oh yeah.
And that's just been a constant area of strength, that relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I just had dinner with her on Saturday night. Yeah, she's a trip. Julie's a trip.
Obviously I don't know your sister. I just met her through the documentary, but she seems lovely.
Yeah, she is lovely, and she's got her own documentary that just came out on Netflix now, Remembering Gene Wilder, that she made with her husband David, and it's a fabulous film. And Julie's a really good person. She's got a lot of wisdom. She's one of my best friends. I rely on her a lot. You know, we went through it together. I'm very grateful for her. My life would have been a lot different if I didn't have her to have gone through the ups and downs of what we experienced. You know, she had a better relationship with my dad, but she also experienced some of his wrath. You know, he could just be brutal. I mean, I remember there was one episode I want to talk just anecdotally is that so Julie just got her license. This is in 1971, the summer of 71, we were in Beverly, Massachusetts. Dad was acting in Fiddler on the Roof, the beginning of his theater career. And, it was Julie was supposed to have the car ready at the back door of backstage, and my dad, we were going to get out of there because the parking lot. So you can't get out of where the North Shore Theater, you know, because it's just one exit, you know, and it's just a big dirt lot and everybody's parked there. So Julie was supposed to have the car ready, and we all jumped in the car and she wasn't ready. We had to go find her. We were parked behind some people and we got stuck in there. And there's my dad in the car, and all these people are walking by the car, and they're going, "Oh my God, there's Leonard!" You know, and my dad's like, he was so angry, and Julie was so like, "Oh my God, it was such a," you know, you don't want to be on the other side of Leonard's disappointment. So I mean, she went a lot through it with me. You know, she knew what I was going through. You know, and she's the one who said, "Look, you know, Dad is just jealous of you being at Cal Berkeley." You know, and she was very sympathetic to my plight with my, she would say things to me, you know, when he would act out like that letter, she'd say, don't let him get away with this.
Oh, wow.
Don't let him get away with it. Don't, you can't let him get away with it. And I was like, yes, I can. And I'm going to, I'm going to.
You write beautifully about your second wife, Martha, in the book. You know, I am not, you know, the idea of soulmates is one that I think is debatable, but the way you write about your relationship with her kind of feels that way, Adam. Yeah. And, I think the way you end up meeting her, I think it's funny how Maddie is giving you shit about, you know, what are you hitting on every receptionist we go, doctor's receptionist we go see. But, you know, just the lead in and the relationship that you had with her, can you talk to the listeners just about, you know, your short time with Martha and how you're doing now years after that?
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, I mean, she was, Martha was kind of mind boggling, you know, it's like, this is her at the wedding.
Okay.
You know what I mean? You get the picture.
I do get the picture.
Yeah. I mean, she's just you a do gorgeous.
You do a great job describing her.
Yeah. She's just a gorgeous girl. And she was, you know, she was very kind and she was very sweet and she was very loving. You know, I mean, girls like this can be trouble.
Yeah.
Well, you know?
Yeah. You write about how sexy she was too, though.
She's just a beautiful girl, and she's, you know, very popular with men, and you know, but she never had an attitude. She was just always just a nice person. Mm-hmm. I just loved her, and she was, you know, I had mixed feelings about her. I mean, even though she was so attractive and so beautiful, I was like, I don't know if I could do this because she was just too conservative. Her family was too crazy conservative, you know? Right. And, you know, I just thought that maybe it was going to be a mixed bag and not something that I was going to pursue. And I didn't know what she was really like anyway. And, you know, and she, you know, and she's very popular with men. And, you know, I just thought like, maybe that's not going to be my thing. Maybe that's too much trouble for me and not something I really wanted to be involved with. The problem with Martha is that she wouldn't let me go. Mm-hmm. And that was the really beauty of it. It's like, she's like, no, we're in this and you're not getting rid of me. You can't get rid of me.
Right.
You know? And she just kept pursuing me, which I just thought like, okay, you know, and that's why I had to go to Justin. It's like, what do I do with her? You know, it's like, what do you do with her? You know, what are you, an idiot? She's amazing. She's gorgeous and she's into you. Just go with the flow. It's not, you know, it's just you're two adults recreating. They say this all the time in AA, you know, you know, just, you know, consenting adults. And I didn't, you know, even then, even after Justin did that, I mean, there's another scene that I wrote that we took out of the book because it was just too much of her. Even after I met with Justin, who said, give it up and just go with the flow. Even after that, I had another lunch meeting with her. And I said to her, look, I'm not sure I'm ready for a long-term relationship. And she came on so strong at the lunch, you know, that we were at that I was just like, I was like, I she was like completely seducing me. I was like, I finally just said, waiter, check, please. We're leaving immediately because she was just so determined. And she said to me, if this doesn't work out with you, I'm giving up on men. That's what she said. So, you know, it's like, look, she wasn't like anybody, you know, she's not like a lot of the other people I knew or dated. And yeah, you know, Maddie had some, you know, trouble getting to know her, which was fine. And, you know, my sister said, Maddie's going to have trouble with anybody who I bring into the relationship.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't really make much difference. So, you know, I just felt lucky that I knew Martha as long as I did. I shared at the meetings. I was just grateful. You know, I don't want to be the victim. You know, it's like, why did this happen to me? And blah, blah, blah. It didn't really happen to me. It happened to her.
Yeah. Right. You
know, she's the one who got sick. I was just there to help her. That's part of being of service. You know, being in AA helps you zoom out and look at the big picture of what it's all about and having gratitude for ever having met her to begin with and to being the guy that was chosen to help her, you know, get off the planet. I mean, you know, I helped Martha. I mean, you know, she... I got to tell you, another small anecdote was that, get this, there was an old friend of mine who that I hadn't seen in many years, and he went through his kids went through the doctor's office.
Okay.
That Martha worked in. Mm-hmm. Because she worked for pediatric orthopedics.
Okay.
If you had a kid on the west side who broke a bone, you went to see this guy. Mm-hmm. So he, you know, he was also kind of enamored with her, let me say.
Uh-huh.
Even though he was married with two kids. I mean, I watch this. A lot of guys would come through and flirt with her because she's so pretty. And she's just sitting there, you know, and you got to make an appointment or talk about the kids. And, you know, and he's chatting her up. And then he came in one day and noticed that she was wearing a ring on her finger. And he said, oh, are you engaged? She said, yes, I just recently became engaged. And he said, well, who's the lucky guy? And she said, Adam Nimoy.
Yeah.
And she said, and this guy, I hadn't seen him in years. The guy went white. And she said, it looked like he was going to pass out.
How'd that guy?
he went, what?
Oh, Adam, I wish we had more time. Can we take about 5 more minutes and ask you 3 canned questions at the end of this thing?
Sure.
Well, and before I do that, yeah, I wish we had another hour. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about, whether it's the book or anything that we didn't get a chance to cover?
Well, the emphasis of the book and the reason for writing the book is that people should take away from it that it's possible to reconcile with a parent who seems to be impossible. It is possible. It can be done. We did it. We proved it. That is the message of the book, that as far apart as my dad and I were, that we found a way back. And, you know, it wasn't easy, and we needed the tools of recovery. And I needed, you know, my friend Chris to tell me to go do it. You know, it can be done. There is hope. There's so much dysfunction out there. There's a lot of dysfunction in families. I mean, just anecdotally, I'd share this at the meetings and people would be inspired to call their parent who they hadn't spoken to in years, or a sibling for that matter. I mean, people should try to repair relationships. We live in a polarized world, and it's a weird time in human history. As a student of history, I can say this, you know, without reservation, we live in a very, very strange, traumatic, challenging time. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of political polarization in this country in particular, all over the world, really.
Yeah.
And if we can make it an opportunity to patch things up at home, I think people should try to think about doing that, because that's where it starts. You know, it's just a message of hope.
Yeah. And I just want to add that I think, you know, there's not only that, there's not only your relationship with your, you know, your famous father, Mr. Spock, but it's also, you know, one man's life as you go through how your self-exploration, how you go through a first marriage and your two kids and going through 12 step. And then, you know, a wife that a second marriage the wife passes. And so it's also just watching you go through your life as well. That, you know, I think is always good for someone to think through, how does this parallel my life? How am I handling the things that arise in my life? And I think, you know, I think you do it really well in the book. So congrats.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I don't do things perfectly, you know, Sean. I make my own mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, I do it, and I have to make amends. And I did it with my mother. I do have emotional relapses where, you know, I just want to let her have it because she just was so ridiculous.
Yeah.
But you know, that's what we have a 10th step for. You've just, you know, you continue to take your own inventory, and when you're wrong, you admit it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And forgive yourself. That's the other thing about 12-step recovery that I didn't really emphasize in the book, is that you need to forgive yourself for making mistakes, because then it's easier to forgive others, you know, and not be so hard on yourself. So I really appreciate that. I hope people, it resonates in some respect and helps people in their own journey.
Yeah, it feels very much, this book feels very much like continued 12th step work, whether that was intentional or not. So yeah, wish you luck with it. When is it going to be released?
It was
published on the 4th of June.
On the
4th. 4th of June. Okay, very good.
It's out there.
Awesome.
The Most Human, at your local bookstores or Amazon.com for the low price of...
We'll put that in the byline for the podcast too.
Yes, we will.
Three quick questions, sort of a la Inside the Actor's Studio, although these are ours, Adam, if you're game. The first one is, and I'm really interested, what do you wish you could have told your 10-year-old self?
What do I wish I could have told my 10-year-old self? That everything's going to work out. It's going to be okay. You know, that 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 I'm not wrong, and I am worthwhile, and I'm worth loving, and I'm going to persevere, and I'm going to, and my dad and I are going to come together at some point in time in our lives. Yeah. Just don't give up. Don't give up. Don't let go. And don't capitulate, and just, you know, stay the course, and everything's going to be fine.
Yeah. Let's all repeat that message many times. Mm. Second question, Adam, do you have a mantra in life or a mantra these days?
Well, it's still a lot of let go and let God for me, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. It's like I don't have control over everything, and I'm doing the best I can. You know, it's I'm doing exactly what Leonard would do in terms of promoting the book. I would like the book to be successful. I would like to have readership. I'm a writer. I want to write more stuff. You know, it's kind of contingent on how well your last project did. Mm-hmm. I hope the book succeeds, but I don't have any control over that. I'm doing exactly what Leonard did, which mm-hmm. was I do the job. I you know, I have publicists who are helping me, and I'm on with you guys. I show up, I do the work, I give as much as I can. I try to make it a meaningful experience, and then I have to see what happens. Not much I can do other than that.
Sure.
So you know, a lot of that, you know, it just works. And when people piss me off, you know, I wanted to drop the dog off at the kennel yesterday because I had this, you know, this swim party here, and the dog, I can't keep the dog out of the freaking pool because she's a lab, you know. And I got to the kennel and they said, nope, sorry, we're filled up. And it's like, you know, for a split second, the typical addict in me was like, F this, take my dog. I'm a regular uh-huh. member here. I paid you guys a shitload of money. Just take the freaking dog. And the other side of me just said, there must be a reason why they can't take my dog.
There you go.
You know, let go and let God. It's just like, I was just, okay, well, thank you very much for your consideration. I appreciate that. And I drove the dog back home, and it's like, you better freaking behave. So we put, so what we did was I put the dog on a leash, and I had my ex-wife, Nancy, dog sit her to keep her out of the pool. And it worked. And she was wonderful. And she was, you know, and everybody, all the kids loved having her here. You know what I mean? It's like, just let go and let God.
It's going to be okay, right?
You know, and if somebody cuts me off on the 405, I know that they really need to get somewhere. Right. It's not right. personal.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Yep. Yeah, I'm never more judgmental than when I'm behind the wheel of a car. So I'm working on that.
Oh, there's so much road rage. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Last question, Adam. What do you hope that people will say about you at your wake? I know.
That I was there for the kids. That's all. I showed up for the kids, all of them. You know, I've got four kids. I've got an older daughter living in Boston. She's 45. I love her. I try to show up for her. I got Maddie and Jonah, and I have a stepson through with Martha. He was here yesterday, Jonathan. I'm still very close with him. I just try to show up for the kids. That alone would be enough. Mm-hmm. You know, and I showed up for my dad too, even mm-hmm. when he was very inhospitable. But mostly it's about the kids. Show up for the kids. That's really all that really matters.
Yeah, I love that. I've said that before. Like, our longest lever for making a positive impact on the world is through our kids, right? You know, especially when there's more than one of them. And in your case, you have four. So I think that's a great wish. Sean, anything else?
No, Adam, thanks for coming. Thanks for writing this book. It was great to read, get to know you and your life. And I hope everybody grabs a copy because it's a good one. You can learn something from it for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Thank you. The Most Human, Reconciling with My Father, Leonard Nimoy. Live long and prosper.
Yeah.
All right, you guys. Thanks so much.
Adam. Thanks, Adam. Take care. Bye-bye.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out, mnliving.org.